Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you all again for being here with us this evening on Occult Science Radio. I am Curtis Davis, a.k.a. The Illuminated One. Well, tonight, I don't feel like such an Illuminated One. Our esteemed guest is the real Illuminated One. And you are going to find out in just a few. I have been following this man's work for quite some time now. And when I came across his work, it really resonated with me because it really made me not only think, okay, critically think and analytically think, but it changed my entire paradigm. And for those of you who are unaware of whom I'm referring to, I am referring to the incomparable Jan Irving. And for those of you who are unfamiliar with his work, you can find his work featured in our main video on theoccultnetwork.com. And after hearing this gentleman and what he has to offer this evening, you're going to see why I give him such high accolades. So we're going to start off by thanking our sponsor, TUN, The Occult Network. That's www.theoccultnetwork.com. There you will find some of the most in-depth esoteric content, educational content that you won't find anywhere else on the net, and you're definitely not going to find it in mainstream media. You could also find The Occult Network on YouTube, Twitter, as well as Facebook. We have a Facebook page. And if you wish to keep up with what's going on Occult Science Radio, as well as The Occult Network, you can also find me on Facebook as well, Curtis Illuminated One Davis. So come by, become a friend of mine on Facebook, and join the Occult Network radio page, Facebook page. And then once you join both pages, then you will be in tune with what's going on with the Occult Network as well as Occult Science Radio. So you're going to want to call in with some questions this evening, family, because believe me, this is going to be a great interview. So please call in with your questions at 646-649-1987. That's 646-649-1987. And if you have a question or a comment, please don't forget to press 1 on your keypad so we can get you on the switchboard and take your wonderful questions and comments. Now, having said all that, it's time to welcome our esteemed guest. And believe me, this is going to be the first of many appearances to come because this gentleman has so much to offer. Family, Jan Irvin. Jan, how are you, my friend, and welcome.
Good, Curtis. Thank you for having me on. I appreciate being here.
Oh, yes. Believe me. I mean, I've watched your documentary, The Pharmacocratic Inquisition, and I've seen several of your lectures, you know, the one that you did in Philadelphia, you know, at the conference, and the one that you just did in Connecticut, and I was blown away. So, you know, before we get started, just give us a little brief background on yourself and what led you to discover the trivium, the quadrivium, and we're also going to talk about magic mushrooms this evening. But yes, you know, I'm really intrigued. You know, I'm really intrigued because, I mean, you know, when I started studying, you know, your website and saw what the trivium and the quadrivium was all about, I was like, now this needs to be taught not only in grade schools, but also in colleges, you know, but that won't be happening anytime soon because then that will unlock people's minds and the quote unquote powers that be would lose control, you know, so we won't see that happening anytime soon. So please, you know, give us some background on yourself, my friend, and what led you to such the great discovery of the trivium and the quadrivium.
Well, that's sort of a long history that led up to the trivium and quadrivium, but for the short version of the story, I started my own podcast at Gnostic Media, which is gnosticmedia.com. And I've been running the show there for about 3.5 years. And about 2.5 years ago, I had this listener of my show email me and send me a couple of pages that he had written. And he had sent this out to a few places. And he was just seeing who would catch on to it and would find interest in it. And it took me a bit to get to the email. And once I finally opened it and read through it, it was one of those epiphany moments. Because in there, he was talking about something that I had been basically referencing across for some time when I was writing my book, Astrotheology and Shamanism, and that being the overlapping sevens and everything, the seven chakras, the seven planets, the 7 days of the week, and as it turns out, of course, the seven liberal or seven liberating arts. And so he's really the one who turned me on to all of this research, and I dove in head first as soon as I came across it and did a whole series with him on my show. And in fact, we've done 4 episodes with him on my show. And then we focused a lot on basically flushing out the rest of the information there on the trivium, going through all of the study material that Gino Denny had recommended, logic studies and going through grammar books and reading Sister Miriam Joseph's book on the trivium and getting all of this stuff integrated into our systems as a systematic way of thinking and verifying information. And so basically, it was, you know, like I said, it was Gene that led me up to the trivium, and it was just my own diligence at studying it and trying to get my head around it that made me study it further. And it probably, if I hadn't written ANS before, I wouldn't have had the inclination to really dig in and start studying the trivia material when Gene sent me his initial emails.
Wow. You know, and what I noticed, you know, because when I first came across it, I said, the trivium, that sounds real interesting. So I went to your website and I said, well, what does it consist of? You know, general grammar, formal logic, classic rhetoric.
And so, classical rhetoric, yeah.
Classical rhetoric. And so I said, okay, you know, looks like I'm going to have to, you know, go through school all over again, because what I'm reading on this website, I mean, it's I'm 49 years young, so it's been a million years since I've been in grade school. Okay, I said, but what this gentleman is offering here was never, ever taught to me in grade school, and I have 2.5 years of college under my belt as well, and I never heard any of this even on the college campus.
Sure. And, you know, in fact, they will tell you, you know, you can go to a liberal arts school and things like that, but what they teach at a liberal arts school is nothing like what we'll be talking about today.
Yeah, and believe me, that's what I'm most interested in. And what I love about the Trivium as I began to study it is, you know, as you said, the senses, the Trivium, and the Quadrivium, and we'll be getting into that shortly.
But, you know, and I should mention, for people to help them follow along while we're getting into this, they can go to my triviumeducation.com website. That's TRIVIUM education.com.
Oh yes, absolutely. Yeah, because I have the link in our chat room as well, so people can go to that link and follow along right along with us. So, you know, when we talk about the Trivium, because one of the things, you know, we basically do the same thing, we just do them differently. And from looking at your lectures, you know, what the knowledge that you're bringing forth, it's really designed to help one see through all the, excuse my excellent command of the English language, but to see through all the bullshit, okay, that we see on TV, you know, and other forms of media.
Sure.
That is
right.
Allowing them to control us. So now, how could we utilize the Trivium to break the chains, if you will?
Well, the Trivium is essentially, it works on a couple of different levels. First of all, it teaches us how to think, not what to think, right? So when we spent all of our time in grammar school and high school and in college, we were taught what to think, but never really taught how to think, how to go through and verify if thoughts that we hold are true or not. So that's the first thing that the Trivium does. The second thing that the Trivium does is it really teaches us how to teach ourselves. So in other words, by studying and learning the Trivium, you become an autodidact. You won't need to appeal to an authority to learn various subjects. You'll become very sufficient in learning all of the core subjects on your own in a level that you would be on par with most university professors. Now, of course, there are some exceptions with hands-on experience and things like that that you know, some experts out there would be able to master you at, but in general, with just going through these processes and learning this stuff, you'll be able to get to teach yourself and get to the core of what you're trying to teach a heck of a lot faster. And the reason why it's faster to learn subjects with the Trivium is because in the Trivium, in the logic aspect, are the logical fallacies. So when you're studying a subject, when you see logical fallacies coming at you in the information that you're taking in, you filter that stuff out. So what happens inadvertently is that you get to the core of what the issue is about a whole lot faster. And so because you don't have to waste time spinning your wheels in muck and in lies, fallacy comes from the Latin word fallare, to lie. And so there's 40, 42 general fallacies that are used most commonly. There's probably upwards of 200 fallacies or more. I mean, there's people will always think of new ways to lie, okay? So, but what happens is when you study the Trivium, and especially beginning when you study the logical fallacies, when somebody lies to you, what happens is you begin to have a switch in your head where instead of having an implicit sort of funny feeling when somebody lies to you, you're going to have explicit knowledge of this person just used this exact lie number B on me, right? So when you first start studying the logical fallacies, you'll stumble at first for the first few weeks, but if you carry a little thing of the logical fallacies in your pocket or in your wallet, or, you know, play, I've put out a YouTube video on the logical fallacies, or play the podcast I did with Michael LaBosier, who I believe you've had on your show, and just constantly go through those logical fallacies. And after a couple of months, in fact, somebody from my work started a website called Fallacy a Day, so that you can go through and learn one fallacy a day in like 5 or 10 minutes or whatever. And so by doing this, you'll build up a foundation that you'll be able to use and protect yourself permanently, especially, and you know, well, what I should say is you don't want to stop just with the logical fallacies. It's really a foundational level, but it's a very key aspect of protecting yourself. And essentially, by learning the logical fallacies, what you're doing is you could think of it as installing a mental antivirus into your brain, just like you have on your computer. And why do we install an antivirus system on our computer and not on our minds? And yet our minds are just as easily manipulated. And so, as we know, our computers run like shit when we have a virus in it, if at all. And that's the same thing as with our brains. They don't run very well. So what happens is, first, when you study the fallacies, you begin to see the fallacies in information coming at you from people you're talking to, things you're reading, the mainstream media, the politicians, the lawyers, marketing campaigns, all of this type of stuff. But what, more importantly, what you'll also be able to start doing is filtering the fallacies from your own thoughts, so that you don't pass bad information on downstream, right? And one thing that I should point out is that the history of the trivium has long been used as a system of mind control by the elites. The elites have been taught various systems of the trivium and grammar and logic and rhetoric in the Ivy League schools and in the mystery schools for centuries. And so... what we're essentially doing with the trivium, and the only way that the elites can use the trivium against you, is by you remaining ignorant of it. And the word liberal, comes from the Latin word liber, which is to be free. And so the word liberal or liberating arts, when we think of the classical seven liberal arts, those arts were reserved for the elite class. And then the rest of the population was taught the mechanical and the servile arts. And so these were tools that, like in ancient Rome, as soon as you became free as a slave, you began immediately to study the seven liberal arts. And so this is sort of the foundation of what it meant between the free and the slave or the indentured class. And so the public schools today, all of the public schools still teach the mechanical and the servile arts. They do not teach the real seven liberal arts. And so what we have is this whole generation, the last century and a half, of people who essentially can't think anymore. And so what the trivium is, and I'll just lay it out really simply, and then we'll go back and review some of the things, is the trivium is grammar, logic, and rhetoric. Grammar answers who, what, where, and when. Logic answers why. And rhetoric explains how. But and what the idea of trivium in unit is mind control, one of the key things to do that, aside from using the logical fallacies that I already mentioned, is to simply mix the trivium up, to take it out of order. And when you take the trivium out of order, let's say if we take logic and we put logic first. Okay, so as I just said, logic is trying to understand why. Well, if you haven't asked who, what, where, or when, how can you understand why? There's nothing there to understand. So you always have to have grammar. And the reason why grammar is who, what, where, and when is because when we look out into the world around us and we see trees, or light poles, or cactus, or a house, or street, or sky, birds, animals, these things, these are all nouns. You know, we can go into adjectives, green, or bird flying, all of these different, you know, verbs, bird flying, all of these different things. And so this is the grammar of what we're dealing with out in reality. So we have to go out and fact check the actual grammar that we're dealing with. And so before we can possibly answer why something is, we have to have asked who, what, where, and when. We have to look at the parts, right? If before you build a house, you want to know all the parts, all the bricks, all the building materials that you're dealing with. Well, that's the grammar. You don't just start with a cleated house. You know, that would be ridiculous. So you have to know the parts, and then so the grammar is the parts. And grammar can also be, you can also look at grammar as knowledge. So you're gaining knowledge of all of the parts out there. And before you can have understanding of those parts, and logic is understanding, you have to gain all of the knowledge, look at it, figure out what's there. Then you can gain understanding. And the logic aspect in answering why something is, logic is the art of non-contradictory identification. So after you've gathered together all of these parts of things that you're looking at, all of these words, all of this grammar, you begin to remove all of the contradictions, all of the fallacies, the appeal to emotion, all of this stuff out, and then you're left with essentially what is the truth. You've asked who, what, where, when, and why. And you always leave room there for new information to come in, because in the trivium, by understanding it as a functioning system, when new information comes in, by understanding the logical fallacies, you won't kill the messenger if somebody brings you new information. You won't use ad hominem attacks to dismiss it or other such fallacies to dismiss the new information. You'll have to properly incorporate it. But once you have all of this information amassed, you have your understanding or your knowledge, your understanding, then when you explain it to somebody else, this is the rhetoric aspect, explaining how something works, and this is what we call wisdom. So you have a systematic process that you've gone through. Step A, I did this. Step B, I did this. Step C, I did this. And then whenever you're looking at the information, you have a systematic process that you went through to reach any conclusion. So when you reach a conclusion, you have either A, which is truth, or you might have A and B or A, B and C. And you know what you need to do to further the research to get down to if it's A or B or A or B or C, right? So you're going to know whatever steps. Okay, like if you're if you're studying some religious thing and you know, I'm going to need to dig in this area of the desert possibly for the rest of my life to find a conclusive answer on this particular matter. So what we're left with is answers A or B, and you're welcome to leave it at that, right? But you have a way that you got there, and maybe somebody else somewhere in the future will pick up where you left off by having left your systematic trail leading to A and B with the last two possibilities, and then they can go out and research from there. Maybe new technology or something comes along, and they can figure it out based on where you left off. And so this is really how the brain naturally works on its own, and through public schools and for your homeschoolers out there in the audience, for those interested in John Taylor Gatto's research and Charlotte Iserbeed and these people, the government has made a systematic effort to dumb down the education system. And when you begin to implement this stuff, you see your mind beginning to switch really quickly to see how people take advantage of you and attempt to manipulate you and things like that. So, essentially that's just an introduction of the trivium itself.
Excellent. Excellent. And when we look at that, formal logic, classical rhetoric, and general grammar, then, you also introduce the quadrivium, which consists of arithmetic, geometry, music, astronomy. Take us through that, my friend.
Well, sure. And the arts that we use for qualifying and quantifying, quantifying all of the information there and making sure that what's there is valid in the information that's out there in nature to us. We look at all of the nouns and adjectives and verbs out in nature, but how do we measure that stuff, right? So arithmetic is number in itself, just by itself. And then geometry is number in space. Music is number in time. And then astronomy is number in space and time. So you go grammar, logic, rhetoric, always in that order, and then geometry or arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy. Now, I should state that there is one exception to the rule with the trivium always being in grammar, logic, and rhetoric in that order, and that's when you're actually learning to study it. When you're actually beginning to study the trivium, it actually helps to have a foundation in logic and the fallacies just to be able to grasp some of the concepts about grammar so that you can apply later on what you've learned in the trivium through grammar. So, you know, we do recommend in actually beginning to study the trivium that you start out with logic. But when you actually apply it, you have to go by who, what, where, when, why, then how. Input, processing, output. Grammar is input. Logic is processing. Rhetoric is output. Just like your computer system, you know, you could think of the keyboard as input. Your computer tower, the CPU inside is the processing unit or logic. And then your monitor, the speakers, printer, all of that is the rhetoric. That's the output.
I see. And, you know, as I stated earlier, you know, I was looking at a great interview that you did just the other day. It was so good that I had to feature it on the network. And, you know, I'm also a student of psychology, you know, and one of my favorite authors is Dr. Nathaniel Brandon. And you used a word that he often uses in his works, autonomy. Okay. And when I heard you using that word in that interview and how you really explained how when one begins to study the trivium and the quadrivium, then one begins to become autonomous, you know.
Well, absolutely. And that's the very reason why they took it away from us in the first place and why they began forcing everyone in compulsory education systems was because of the autonomous spirit. That is exactly what they had to break. And so when people are able to see, here's the thing is when you can think clearly and based on the information coming into your five senses at any given time, you're able to filter your fallacies out and things like that. Your self-esteem goes up dramatically because you're going to be far more self-assured that the decisions that you're making at any given time is the right decision, okay? And so when it comes to your autonomy, when you want to run a business or you want to write a book about something or do all of these various things, you're going to have a sense of self-sufficiency or autonomy. You're not going to need to run to a college professor or this or that to authority person to get the answer. See, let's say if you're studying music, okay, and using the trivium method by learning how to learn, you learn the history of music, where it comes from through the quadrivium and everything, the foundation of where the notes originated and all of this stuff. And then once you have a good, clean understanding of what music is and where it originates, then instead of always going back to your music teacher every time you want to learn to play a new song, then you know and have the foundations of music itself to create your own music, right? So that's the key difference. And the whole idea that the system is structured on now is to force you to always go to some authority to find out the answers because they haven't taught you how to think. They want to, whether it's a politician with, and even government itself is an appeal to authority fallacy. It's an ad baculum fallacy. Maybe you should have Larkin Rose on your show. He's a friend of mine. But, there is no government in today's society without committing acts of violence on your neighbors. So whenever you vote, you're giving other people in your community permission to go abuse other people and steal their money for this mythical concept that actually doesn't exist called government. And government is the largest actual religion in the world. There is no thing that you can point at, no person and say, well, that's government. Government is a concept or an idea that everybody puts on costumes and uniforms and acts out. And so, you know, by acting as the priest or the hierophant or the president, as it's called, and then everybody below him and all of his religious minions, this is the largest government in the world today, or excuse me, the largest religion government. And all of this is based on this false concept of an appeal to authority, which, of course, the idea behind and a false appeal to authority is to take your autonomy away. So when you give somebody else the right to steal money from your neighbors to build roads or to do whatever, that's authority that you didn't have to give away in the first place, because under natural law, your freedom ends where my nose begins, and everything is based on voluntary action. So this is why this issue always comes back to autonomy. And of course, psychiatry, the entire field, is designed to break down and subvert people's autonomy to get them to bend to the will of authority. And you'll often hear psychiatrists talk about this or that person is a rebel, or they refuse to follow authority and things like this. Well, that's because authority is a fallacy. It's a lie.
Right. Very, very well put, you know, because, you know, in my studies that, you know, one of the things that I discovered is that true education, you see, what we're looking at out here today is indoctrination. It's not education. You know, a true education, when you, especially when you use the word autonomy, true education, as they say in the mystery, what they did in the mystery schools in ancient Egypt, was to bring this out of you, was to bring this information out of you, as opposed to the educational system that we came up in, where they constantly putting things into you, and you're not really being educated. You're just being taught to obey, you know.
Exactly.
You know, so now, once again, you know, when I look at this information, the trivium and the quadrivium, it is the perfect weapon to use against the quote-unquote powers that be.
Well, keep in mind, you got to keep in mind that it's the perfect weapon that they've been using against us for more than 2,000 years. So all we're doing is we're leveling the playing field so that their weapon becomes impotent, right?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. You know, and that's what really needs to happen, you know, because, you know, when I listen to people like yourself, people like Mark Passio and, you know, Nathaniel Brandon, you know, I wanted to say that you're very libertarian in your thinking, you know, and I love that because, you know, I've always been a quote unquote rebel myself, you know.
But at the same time, I'm not libertarian either because, you know, I would never support the Libertarian Party because that would be against the entire concept. I mean, you might say that, you know, to most extents and purposes, I'm an anarchist. And an anarchist Yes. is just based on volunteer participation. Your grocery store is run on anarchy. Whenever you pull up to a stop sign, that's anarchy. You don't have anybody there who's going to you know, put a gun in your mouth and tell you how it's done. If you don't want to work at the grocery store anymore, you leave, right? If you don't want to shop there anymore, you leave, and everything works just fine. And so you know, what's happened is basically because of money and money issues, either trying to protect us from the elite's control over gold supplies, or trying to keep false receipts from spreading. These governments have spread, and I recommend people read two very important works on the history of money. One is called The Babylonian Woe by David Astle. Another one is Stephen Zarlinga's The Lost Science of Money. And while Stephen Zarlinga proposes a state-based solution, as as Larkin Rose points out in his research, if you can get the money power to become a tool of the people, then it's really no longer government. And so, hold on just a second. My phone is ringing here. Let me turn it off.
Certainly.
All right. Sorry about that. And you know, so anyway, where was I?
No, you were saying that you know, Larkin Rose was talking about the, money.
Yeah, it's basically, though, as soon as you get the money, power, and everything as a servant of the people rather than as something that's there to control and enslave the people, then it's no longer government. Then the people are no longer being subverted by it. So Zarlinga's plan just may well work, but I am very cautious in his state-based solutions. As long as things are made completely open to public scrutiny and you know, a method is figured out so that private bankers don't have a way to charge false interest and things like this on the money, then things would actually work. But there's a lot more to the history there that isn't talked about, and I, you know, people hate on me every time I bring up the gold issue. But if you study Stephen Zarlinga and David Astle's works, they bring up some serious issues over the history of gold and how gold has been manipulated through commodities for centuries. And one person who has a commodity that another one needs will co-opt either your group or tribe or whatever for that commodity and refuse to trade in it. And people will say, well, in an open market system, you would just go to somebody else. Well, sorry, buddy, if somebody is the sole source for a product that you need and you need to survive, you're gonna pay whatever you can in whatever type of money you can get to pay it. And the idea that you can always just go somewhere else in a free market that has never existed, by the way. I mean, to create this free market, you would have to snap your fingers and poof, magic, it suddenly exists. But this isn't something that's ever existed. And sure, we can philosophize about it all day long and talk about implementing something like that. But, and you know, how would you force everyone onto a system like that? Or how would it work without using force in the first place, which negates the whole thing? So we run into philosophical problems of how to get to that sort of true free market system that can't be co-opted. But money is one of the primary issues in how the elites use to, you know, get themselves in power and then put a government under them to control everybody else and basically extract wealth and energy out of the proletariat or the dead to feed themselves, you know, sort of like the Matrix batteries.
Yes, indeed. And I mean, and when I look at what's going on in, you know, in our society now, Jan, you know, not just here in the United States, but globally, how slowly but surely, right under people's nose, you know, but unfortunately, many people are distracted by American Idol and Donald Trump show and so on.
That's
and
the
so
whole
forth.
Idea. That's
yeah.
The whole idea.
You know, so much. That's why what you.
You can imagine all of that time that people waste on looking at other people's fantasies and
exactly.
instead focus on their own passions.
Uh-huh.
See, that's the idea, is to get you to not follow your passions. See, like you and I, we figured that out. You've got your own radio show. I'm a writer. I've got my radio show. I do documentaries and things like this. We've figured that out to follow our passions, and that's the key to finding your way out of the mess. But the whole idea of American Idol and things like that is to not only, one, waste your time, but two, waste your time on somebody else's passions and fantasies, right?
Exactly. Exactly. So now this is why, you know, the Trivium and the Quadrivium are so very vital, you know, to the world now. Because, you know, people are so distracted that they don't realize that our rights are slowly but surely being taken away from us. You know, I was looking at a lecture the other day by a gentleman by the name of Dr. Walter E. Williams. And what is going on in our society now is that they're taking trivial things. You know, in other words, you know, somebody, it's getting to the point now where if, you know, if you're caught smoking a joint, you know, you could end up like doing like 10 years in prison. You know?
Well, you know, and it's very important for them to keep the plants and the, especially the teacher plants, illegal, because too many people have accidental awakenings when they're under the influence of marijuana or mushrooms or LSD or ayahuasca or DMT and these things, and they figure out suddenly that they're being lied to, and then they go and try and tell others, hey, look, you know, try this. Look, you'll realize that this is all a lie. And so, you know, that's a big issue that the elites have used the entheogens or the psychedelics for their own religious purposes since the dawn of time, and have very often throughout history suppressed the rest of our uses for it. And even the Eleusinian mysteries in ancient Greece, while they allowed everyone, even the slaves, to partake in the ritual, they certainly didn't tell everybody what was in the secret Kaikion psychedelic drink there. And so they were able to still control everybody by occulting that knowledge. And as you are aware, when you occult information, the entire purpose of occulting that information is to use it as a control system against others.
Yes, indeed. And speaking of which, you know, I notice, you know, in our private conversation and from studying your information, you've recently begun doing a lot of work with magic mushrooms. And I became intrigued by that. So, yes, please take as much time, you know, to tell us about magic mushrooms. And, you know, is it anything like marijuana, ayahuasca, you know, and so on and so forth? And what benefit does it offer to those, you know, who wish to research this further?
Well, that's opening a whole big can of worms there. Well, I've written a couple of books on the history of magic mushrooms and the use of religion, primarily focusing on Judeo-Christianity. My last book was called The Holy Mushroom, Evidence of Mushrooms in Judeo-Christianity, and I published the first ancient primary text in the field that actually specifically discusses, and it was an ancient Christian text from Mount Athos Peninsula in Greece. It was the first Christian text ever published that specifically discussed the holy mushroom. And in 1970, John Allegro, and I'm the publisher of this book now, he came out with a book called The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross, arguing that Judeo-Christianity was based on a fertility drug cult. And John Allegro wasn't just a nobody. He was one of the original eight translators of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And so over the last, well, since about 2003, 2004, I started investigating Allegro's background and the history of information against him, because I just, you know, I knew that a lot of his research was correct. So in my last book, in the Holy Mushroom book, I sort of break down and analyze the disinformation campaign against him and show that there was an intentional effort made to propagandize Allegro's information and to put it in a bad light, essentially even before it went to print. And so when the key person, and the reason why I'm getting into this study now, which I'm hoping to turn into a new book and documentary, is that this guy who did all of these things, and I'm not talking about Allegro, but the other guy who did the things against Allegro and propagandized him, was actually the guy who launched the entire psychedelic movement. And he's the guy on top of that who is given credit as, excuse me, having discovered magic mushrooms. And he created the academic field of study called ethnomycology, which is the study of how indigenous cultures or various cultures around the world use psychedelic mushrooms for religious purposes. You know what? I'm going to need some more water here. Can we take a minute?
Sure. Not a problem. Go ahead, my friend. And while you're getting your water, you know, we're going to play a little musical cut. And then at the end of the musical cut, we will be right back with Jan Irving, author of The Trivium. We will be right back, family. Stay tuned.
Pure gold, yeah. in the light. Won't you wake up? Wake up. Bring substance in your life. Won't you wake up? Wake up. Walk in the light. Won't you wake up? Wake up. Yeah. Where's your heart? Where's your pride? Has it all been put aside? Life is dreams, living high, yet no substance in your life. It's a hard world, all I know, but don't give in to the lie. You have always been a star. Everything you need's inside your heart.
Of ethnomycology, the discoverer of magic mushrooms, and the launcher of the psychedelic movement. And so when I was going through all of that research on these characters and exactly what happened, I began to look into Wasson's background. And there is a large archive maintained at Harvard University's Herbaria that is all based on Gordon Wasson's research and the study of magic mushrooms and everything there. And so, you know, I was thinking I would start there and go through the typical channels and of finding information. But then I realized, well, you know, 40 years of researchers have been through that archive there at Harvard, and they didn't find anything. But yet I'm finding all of this evidence and all of this stuff that points to another direction, that he's not at all who he said he was. And then I stumbled across documents. In fact, I started researching through Columbia University, Yale, Princeton, Stanford, a number of other library archives, such as those. And I discovered that, primary documentation, first off, that Wasson served as a chairman to the Council on Foreign Relations. And it turns out that when Wasson published this Life magazine article on May 13th, 1953, which we're coming up on the 55th anniversary in about a week and a half here, 2 weeks, what he didn't let everybody know at the time was that his actual boss at J.P. Morgan Bank was a guy by the name of Henry P. Davison. And Henry P. Davison helped Henry Luce in establishing Time Life magazine. So Wasson's own boss was a director and co-startup manager and funder of the Time Life Corporation, the Time Life startup, as were two other partners at J.P. Morgan Bank where Wasson worked. And then, as it turns out, Henry P. Davison and Henry Luce were both, and Britton Hayden were both, or all three Skull and Bones, and they all graduated Yale and Skull and Bones initiated class of 1920. And so we have all these little ties between Skull and Bones, between Time Life magazine and J.P. Morgan as the startup and the foundation of the entire psychedelic movement. Now, you know, somehow people managed to buy the story that Wasson was just a banker, just a Wall Street banker. Nobody ever bothered to notice the fact that he was the vice president of public relations or propaganda for J.P. Morgan Bank, right? I mean, you couldn't get any more questionable than that. And then I start digging some more, and I find documents that Wasson hung out with the father of propaganda, Edward Bernays, for 10 years. And I find other documentation that Wasson was hanging out with guys like Alan Dulles, the head of the CIA, John Foster Dulles, the head of the U.S. State Department, April Harriman, who was famous for funding the Nazis, again, Henry Luce and all these people at this private club called the Century Club at New York. And in fact, even guys like Dwight Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, were members there. And Wasson himself was a key member there because he nominated people like Frank Ashtole, the director of the CFR, and the guy who is behind Operation Mockingbird. And he also nominated George Kennan, who was a CIA operative and the ambassador to the Soviet Union to the Century Club. So, you know, here we have all of these documents today of Wasson on one side working with the intelligence community, and then on the other side establishing this big lie that the public bought for all these decades. And when the trail got hot and somebody started to suspect that Wasson was a CIA agent, one of the guys that was on his trip to Mexico when they discovered the mushrooms in 1953, they set him up as the fall guy for the whole thing, a guy by the name of Dr. James Moore, who was also a CIA asset. But so that the story wouldn't get hot on Wasson and people wouldn't follow up that Wasson himself was the CIA asset, working himself directly with the head of the CIA and the Council on Foreign Relations on all of this stuff, well, they just simply inserted a fall guy or a scapegoat into the storyline. And so for the last several decades, all of these people have chased after James Moore, thinking, oh, well, the CIA, in a failed attempt to, you know, get Wasson's information and to co-opt him, you know, sent this CIA agent into the field with him. And, you know, they actually buy this stuff. And nobody bothered to look into Wasson's background for 40-some years. But the only way I was able to do it is I actually got banned from the Wasson's archive at Harvard University, and I had to go through and reverse engineer through other universities all of this documentation, which I wouldn't have found anyway if I just gone straight to the Harvard archives to look for it.
Wow. You know, I mean, this is information. I mean, I've been doing this a long time, Jan, but this is information that I'm hearing for the first time. With regard to the characters involved. You know, I had no knowledge of this. You know, and it just proves, you know, why what you have to offer, you know, can really open people's eyes. You know, now how I first came across, you know, the knowledge of mushroom, I was, I was studying the works of a gentleman by the name of Terence McKenna, you know, and for the first time when I was looking at it, I pretty much said the same thing that, you know, I just said to you a few minutes ago in jest. I was like, well, wait a minute now. We've always been taught that, you know, these narcotics are illegal. And
when I see somebody who, you know, posted up on your forum here, I attended HBCU in the early 70s and people drank mushroom tea then. It was illegal and punishable by expulsion then. Yeah. Of course it was. It was actually psychedelics became illegal in 69, 70, right around there, 67 to 70. And but what's interesting is the same people that promoted them to be legal in the first place, Henry Luce in Time Life magazine is the major person. In fact, Timothy Leary learned about it through Luce. So any credit given to Timothy Leary is given to Luce. And so, you know, these guys, they popularized it, and then I have a quote from Henry Luce's wife saying that afterwards they wanted to get, you know, put a lot of propaganda out there. So then once Time Life, they started this whole psychedelic movement, then they reversed all of the propaganda and started putting all the stuff out there about take it seven times and you'll go crazy and all of this nonsense that's never been proved at all. It's just fear tactics to get people hyped up and afraid of the stuff. But so what they did first was they popularized them, brought them out into the public, and then they banned them. And, you know, and the elites have used these psychedelic substances for many, many, many centuries. You can follow, you know, just, you know, for instance, tracing it back through Christianity, you can trace the use of these substances far back into history. Myself, Professor Carl Ruck at Boston University, Clark Heinrich, there's a number of researchers in Europe like Wolfgang Bauer, and a number of others have put out a lot of research on these ancient religious myths being developed out of psychedelics. And now we have a lot of iconography, primary documents to back up what we're talking about, whereas when John Allegro first came out and proposed that just Christianity alone was based on this stuff, He only was working from linguistic analysis. And the interesting part is this guy, Gordon Wasson, who did all of these attacks against Allegro, he had no problem coming out and saying that the soma of the Rig Vedas was the Amanita muscaria mushroom, which is a theory which is the most widely accepted theory today in academia on what soma was. So here's this same guy who could say that, okay, it was okay for soma to be the mushroom, but not for mana, right? And the mana that's found in the when you get into Strong's Concordance and look at the mana of the wilderness, it comes from a field whither cattle are driven. And where do psilocybe mushrooms grow, especially psilocybe cubensis, but in cow dung? And so even this Bible reference points us directly to a very possible link to mana and psilocybe psychedelic mushrooms. And you had asked earlier, what can we do with the mushrooms? I don't know. Medically speaking, they're using them in preparation for death, for cancer, anxiety treatment, and things like that. Johns Hopkins University has been pioneering a lot of the research on psilocybe types of mushrooms and psilocybin specifically, and they've published a number of studies since 2006 or so showing that the religious experience from psilocybin mushrooms is indistinguishable from any of the religious or mythical experiences reported by any of the religions throughout time.
Interesting. And now I notice now, from what I'm seeing, the battle is raging on now over marijuana, which you and I know, is absolutely...
Now?
yeah, I know, right?
Yeah, I've already spent about 20 years on the front lines of that one, and I've already lost dozens of friends in that war. So, when you say it's just now raging on, I mean, we were the ones... My friends and I worked with Jack Hare back in the 90s and 2000s, were the ones that in 96 we passed Prop 215 for medical marijuana in California. We were on the forefront of that stuff since the beginning of it. And, it's their breadbasket. And, of course, Obama's a politician, and anybody who is dumb enough to believe what he said about not going after the the medical marijuana clubs and stuff was stupid, and we all bought it. We all wanted that hope, but guess what? Now we know hope is a fallacy. So when Ron Paul uses that same fallacy, we know this time not to fall for it, right?
Exactly. And so many people out there, believe in Ron.
It's Ron Paul has turned into a religion, and as soon as you study and comprehend the fallacy of advercundium, which is the false appeal and belief, and giving your authority over to someone else to rule your life for you, this make-believe entity called government, and then you're going to get somebody like Ron Paul to supposedly, go in there, and he's going to, I guess, what do you want him to do? You, go to Congress and ask them to give you a little bit more freedom, as Larkin would say? The whole concept is ridiculous. As soon as people stop believing and the appeal to authority fallacy, we can all just turn around and ignore the politicians, and they will have no power, period. But, it's waking up enough people to the reality that government is a religion and is based on a false appeal to authority fallacy. It's getting enough people to wake up to that idea that will eventually free them. And thanks to the internet, it's a meme that's spreading very quickly.
Yes, indeed. I know you've also, done a lot of work with shamanism, or shamanism, as many people call it, Jan. And, you've got some great work out there, the Pharmacratic Inquisition and, ayahuasca, now. Admittedly, I just, really, I'd say within the last year or two, really began to really gain a knowledge of ayahuasca. I mean, everybody's heard about marijuana. Everybody's heard about LSD and so on and so forth. But then I was watching your work, and I was also watching another documentary concerning shamanism, where they were talking about ayahuasca. You know, please go more in depth about, because many people prior to this broadcast really wanted to know what it was and you know, what was its pros and what's its cons.
Well,
and so,
first off, why don't we start off with the word shamanism, and then we'll go into ayahuasca and the other stuff.
Yes.
You know, shamanism is a Siberian word that comes primarily from the various tribes who would use Amanita muscaria mushrooms. It's become a very generic term. It's become a watered-down New Age religion in the West over the last couple of decades, thanks in large part to Terence McKenna, to Carlos Castaneda, and the like. And, you know, Terence McKenna selling the idea that a shaman is someone who's been to the other side and lived to tell about it, or come back and lived to tell about it, as being the definition of a shaman. But it's a lot deeper than that, and in fact, there was a professor, and he just died a few weeks ago, Professor Neil Whitehead from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, had written a number of books on dark shamanism.
Yes, yes.
And the like. And, you know, just as much as there is good shamanism and light shamanism, there is dark shamanism. And it's such a fine line between the two, because you have to study the exact same things to use them for good or for bad, right? And you learn about the same plants and chemicals and the same tricks of the trade. One of them uses them to empower others, and the other one really uses them for manipulating people. And then there's red and green shamanism on top of that. And then the shamanism that our culture is sold is a whole neo or new age shamanism that isn't really reflective of most indigenous shamanism at all. And, you know, indigenous shamanism focuses a lot on retribution. If you get sick in the jungle, it's usually because somebody was thought to have cast a spell on you or something, right? And so there's a lot of retributive killing and stuff like this that goes on. And, you know, there's darts, invisible darts that they'll throw at people, and, you know, energy darts and things like that that are designed or based on jealousy and these types of things. And there's a lot of this dark stuff that goes on, and a lot of the dark shamanism is surrounded in heavy tobacco use. Tobacco, especially tobacco, Nicotiana rustica, is actually a psychedelic. And, you know, there's a lot of disinformation about tobacco, but tobacco has been, you know, fully commodified and commercialized in our society. And originally, when you would take tobacco, you would, you know that funny feeling? I don't know if you've ever had a cigarette, but it just, you know, you start getting spins and you feel like you're getting high from it and things like that. And this is because at higher doses, like Nicotiana rustica, the nicotine in it was far stronger, and you would have a psychedelic experience from it. So this is one of the tools that the dark shamans use, and they would suck the macraba, or this is going to gross out your listeners, but what they do is they stick a reed into the ground, they kill somebody through torture, and they fill them full of various herbs and things like that, and then they bury them in the ground, and then a week or two later they come and they suck this nectar, this death juice with the plants and herbs and blood from this person's body, and they suck it out of the ground through a reed, and they consume it to empower themselves. So shamanism is, you know, it's really a generic term. And, you know, in South America now, it's, you know, curandero or ayahuasquero. And there's, you know, people use San Pedro cactus and other types of cactus and things like that. So, and there are different groups of cultures that we call shamanism today that don't use any psychedelics. But generally, you know, they might use drumming techniques and music or breathing techniques and things like that, or bodily torture or some of them even use plant poisons or insect poisons. So there are all of these different aspects that fall under this generic term shaman that used to just be for a few tribes of people up in Siberia. And so that's the problem with the word. Now, you know, ayahuasca itself is a brew, And it's composed typically, and there are many ayahuasca analogs, but it's composed typically of Banisteriopsis caapi vine and Psychotria viridis. And it's a brew that's typically brewed over about 20, 24 hours. And it's one of the most hideous things that you could ever possibly get down. And at the same time, one of the most fantastic, beautiful experiences. It's called La Purga. It makes you throw up. And basically all of this stuff that you're throwing up is this bad energy or negative bile and all of this stuff that gets built up in you. And so you purge it out, and you can literally feel all of this negative energy and crud and bad experiences that you've had with people or events and things in your life. You feel this stuff come out with the vomit. And so, you know, it's very interesting, and it's, you know, it's used both religiously and medicinally in the jungles of South America because of the large number of stomach parasites, and they can also use it to cleanse out things that are negatively impacting the stomach, different parasites. So, and it dramatically increases night vision. I've personally had full-blown telepathy on it with a group of people, and it's, you know, telepathy is one of the things that most researchers are very shocked to find in almost all of the psychedelic literature, or the scientific literature about psychedelic drugs. One of the most common things throughout all of it is the repeated mention of telepathy. And so you find that with ayahuasca and with mushrooms and with LSD and with peyote. And, you know, there's a few key things that are underlined there that you cleanse through and you free yourself. But it's what's interesting, and I'm going to go take a step back, because due to MK Ultra and the mind control aspects that psychedelics can also be used for, they can, as much as they can be used to free somebody, they can be used to control somebody. As there are dark shamans and light shamans, psychedelics are good, and psychedelics can do just as much damage and bad, as we found out in the 50s and 60s with MK Ultra and some of the secret stuff that's still going on today. But with psychedelics, the safest way to take them and not be allowed to be mind controlled, and you know, Professor Marlene Dobkin de Rios goes into some of this research on how shamans use some of the psychedelics. There's a state when you're under the experience where somebody can come in and easily reprogram you to what they want you to believe. And so, you know, shamans out in the jungle will use these techniques, and you can follow directly the line from the shaman into the priest class and the kings into the modern governments. It stems right out of the jungle straight up, and you can, you know, they're pretty clean line there from the shamans on up. And so this shaman becomes the chief of the priest and takes control or manipulates for his own benefit some people in his tribe, and might only pass this information on to his son, right? And so because of this usurpation of psychedelics for mind control purposes throughout history, as has been done, the key way to prevent that from happening is to study something like the trivium, so that you have a systematic way to spot the fallacies, to question yourself, and to go back and fact check things, so that when somebody's trying to manipulate you on these things, you have an antivirus system installed in your brain, so that you don't end up like, you know, one of these New Agers out on Melrose Avenue waiting for the next channeling experience to tell you everything, right? And so you have a systematic method of not only taking what you just, if you want to call it channel, I'm not saying that stuff is real, because like I just said, I've had many telepathic experiences and the like myself. But you need a systematic way to go out and verify what you gain in reality. And if there isn't a way, like if you read Peter Gorman's book on ayahuasca, for instance, he's constantly looking for ways to verify the information that he gets from his visions in reality. And so this should always be done. And too often in the New Age and psychedelic community, and they've, in recent times, they've kind of been indistinguishable thanks to guys like Terrence McKenna, Daniel Pinchbeck, and these guys. They've kind of convoluted the lines quite a lot. But because of this stuff, there's just, you know, these blind spots in there that people, and I kind of lost my train of thought on there, but they just need to be aware of so that they don't get caught into the mind control aspects. And by having that systematic method of the trivium minimally, and also the quadrivium even better, then you protect yourself when you're going through this stuff. And the cool thing is that, you know, is studying logic, a lot of people are going to think, well, won't logic destroy your spirituality? Won't you, like, be led away from God like some raving atheist? I don't think so at all, personally, because, you know, studying the trivium, you know, certainly you're not going to become some dogmatist religious fanatic, because, you know, something like the Bible, when when somebody tells you that it's written by God, that's a contradiction. And logic is part of non-contradictory identification. When you look out in nature, you know that God creates trees and birds and rivers and clouds and skies and planets and stars and things. But, you know, nowhere out there did God create book. And if God suddenly creates book, then that's a contradiction. And there's a contradiction right there. And I've got to remove that contradiction in logic. Ah, man wrote that book. Contradiction removed. Problem solved. Somebody wrote this book to, and it turns out to be the Flavian family, to manipulate and control others. And so, and I recommend listeners, and maybe you should interview for your show, Joseph Atwell, the author of Caesar's Messiah, that goes into how the Roman Caesars created the story of the Christian version that's come to us today of Jesus, and then, of course, the emperor being the Lord God. So by having a way to go through and fact check everything, essentially, you can go through and make sure that you're not being manipulated. And that is the key issue, is being able to go through and fact check yourself. And whether it's inductive or deductive that you do it, you still need to go through and fact check yourself and make sure that you're basing your decisions on sound claims. You know, basing all of your decisions because somebody told you that XYZ happened from the Pleiades, and Zachariah Sitchin told you this or that, and you haven't gone out to verify this information yourself, then you're being misled. And it's a mighty big industry misleading millions of people today.
Wow. You know, so now if these are the benefits, you know, and I do emphasize that word benefit that ayahuasca offers you, you know, then this is something that I suspect that the government is really going to lean on people to make sure it doesn't become widespread. You know,
well, see, this is the issue, is that, you know, first, the government and these people are behind popularizing it, loose Skull and Bones, the CIA, all of this stuff, and then they outlaw it. And now the movement is to, through Rick Doblin and the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, to commodify all of the psychedelics, right? So now what will happen is the government will legalize all of the psychedelic drugs, and they'll be used for clinical applications, clinical psychology, and you'll go to your therapist, and he'll administer you ecstasy or LSD or mushrooms or what have you. And then because it's all done under the authority of the government, you'll accept the false appeal to authority, right? It's like Aldous Huxley's Soma. They're using it to dumb down and quell the masses. So, you know, this is a very risky business, commodifying and using spiritual substances that should be free to everyone and just out there as they've always been for thousands of years. When you start controlling them under the medical sense, it gets really dangerous, and this is a point where they can be used for further mind control.
Oh, yes, because, I mean, I suspect that, you know, if the government gets their hand on it, you know, their objective is not going to be to assist people in their self-evolution.
Well, it's going to be, you know, like I said a minute ago, they're going to assist in the spiritual evolution to a point. But as I was pointing out with Marlene Dobkin de Rios' research, and she used to be professor of anthropology at Cal State Fullerton, and now she's an assistant associate professor of psychiatry or psychology at UC Irvine, and she points out how they use this stuff. So when you're in this state, under a clinical setting, the government can just give you this idea that, you know, it's the kind big brother who allowed you to have this spiritual awakening, right? So they'll allow you to go so far and then not allow you to realize that that was the whole point of having Big Brother give it to you in the first place, was to have a false trust in Big Brother.
I see. I see. I mean, as diabolical as they are, you know, I mean, they are clever in their application. You know, I mean,
absolutely. You know, and it's a dialectic, and this is why studying the trivium is so important, because, you know, I used to think that psychedelics were mostly harmless, and medically speaking, as far as health problems, mental problems, are pretty much harmless. You know, you're not going to go insane from doing LSD 7 times. I mean, I would have gone insane probably 50 or 70 times over by now at those numbers. So, you know, it's, and that's just with LSD. So it's, you know, there's so much disinformation out there to mislead people and to get them to fear what these things are and what they do. And there is a very good reason for that. But at the same time, be careful of the agendas to commodify them and have them passed out at your local Wynn's pharmacy, you know?
Oh, yes. Well, I don't see that happening anytime soon, Jan. Because
Walgreens or whatever. Well, you know, it's actually happening fast. If you watch the newspapers, just in the last week or two, LSD studies coming out again, ecstasy studies coming out again. It's for the last several years, it's been a regular occurrence in the media, and you're going to see it coming up a lot more over the next 10 years. I expect that we'll see the full rescheduling of just about all of the psychedelics for medical use in the next 10 to 20 years.
Yeah, and I think they've pretty much begun that with marijuana, because now, you know, I mean, I was just in L.A. last year, you know, and you and I both know about the quote-unquote medical marijuana.
Well, it is medical, and that's the thing, is people have endocannabinoids, okay, which regulate your synaptic nerves and how your system talks to itself. And without endocannabinoids, your body doesn't function well. It can lead to schizophrenia and all sorts of health problems. Additionally, you know, our culture, humanity, has lived hand in hand with cannabis or with the hemp plant since the dawn of time. It was our clothing, our lighting oil, our food. Porridge used to be made out of hemp. You know, original Gutenberg Bibles were written on hemp. It was one of the first paper sources, you know, aside from papyrus. And, you know, so we have this very ancient, long history with the hemp plant. It does, in fact, beyond any doubt, treat glaucoma. It does not cause cancer. Every study that's shown that THC, in fact, applied directly to tumors will kill and actually revert the tumor cells. Treating, you know, I've had major stomach problems for 14 years that I'm still battling with, but it's nausea and things like that. So, you know, migraines is also treated with it, PMS and all of these other things. And what you have is a situation where there are so many toxic drugs out there that are accepted that you can buy at any pharmacy, that you can go to your doctor and get, you know, 50% of the medications out there, in small or large part, can be replaced by cannabis. So that the idea that you shouldn't try cannabis first is absurd. And, you know, being that it has so many applications, you know, it's some doctors in California, if you can't, just like they might give you Prozac if you're distracted or, you know, you can't concentrate or whatever, they will give you cannabis to help you with writing now and to help you focus on certain things. So it is actually the medical application across the board, even if people are self-medicating because of endocannabinoids and because, you know, our bodies are designed for cannabis consumption, and it's been a literally our staff of life. We wouldn't be here without it. There's just no reason really why cannabis shouldn't always be your first line of defense with any medical problem. And in fact, just you know, a quarter mile from my place, a 5 or 7 minute walk is a very excellent Medical Marijuana Club that usually has anywhere from 20 to 35 different strains available at very good prices. And they found that around the clubs, the crime rate has diminished dramatically, violent and nonviolent crime alike. So, you know, the whole drug war, it's something that I've studied a long time, and there's just a lot of profit in keeping it illegal, both for the growers and for the government and the black markets and the police. And in fact, when last year, when marijuana was up for a couple of years ago for up for legalization here in California, the growers who stand the biggest, the most to lose from having it outlawed were the ones who paid for a lot of the disinformation to keep marijuana illegal in the state of California.
You're kidding.
No.
What?
Of course. I mean, you know, they don't want a lot of these growers are afraid that, you know, somebody might plant a hemp farm and destroy their crop instead of just putting in air filters or something. And, you know, I mean, you know, it's like, yeah, sure, you're going to have some pollination, but, you know, we're looking at something that can be used for paper, fiber, fuel, food, medicine, all of these different things. And then you have these greedy sons of bitches at every turn who, rather than doing things for the greater interest, have, you know, and thinking rationally through the trivium, turn to their selfish irrationality and do things like help the government keep marijuana illegal.
Wow. You know, I'm not surprised, you know, because it's pretty much like the, you know, like the big boys, how they finance both sides of a war, or, you know, the big boys, how they finance both candidates that are running against each other. So, I mean, I guess, you know, I really shouldn't be surprised, you know. But time went by too fast, Jan. I'm already planning your next visit. Oh, this was a pleasure, my friend, and believe me, like I said, everybody, oh, trust me, Jan just scratched the surface here this evening. You know, if you really begin to follow this gentleman's work, you will see that, I mean, his work and his research is extraordinary. So as we wind down, Jan, just let everybody know how we can get our hands on your book, you know, and
sure,
what you got going on, and any other information you wish to share
with us.
Well,
I've got a couple of books out now, and I'm working on a couple of more right now. But my first book is Astrotheology and Shamanism. The second book is called The Holy Mushroom. Those can both be found on my website at GnosticMedia.com. That's GnosticMedia.com. And they can also check out my podcast at that website, where I've also interviewed more than 50 of the world's leading psychedelic experts on this stuff, and done a lot of work on the trivium and everything there. They can also purchase John Allegra's The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross book there. And the Trivium Education website is where people can go to find out more specifically on the Trivium studies, get books and information on that. There's a lot of that stuff over on the Gnostic Media website as well. In fact, probably even more. But I gear the Trivium Education website more for family and education-oriented, so you won't find a bunch of stuff on psychedelics at the Trivium Education website. So you can feel safe to send your families to that one. And what else? Oh, the Pharmacratic Inquisition DVD is up there. I've got a book that I finished recently, a comprehensive overview of the what is it called again? Goodness, I can't even remember the title of my own book. How's that for? Entheogens and Consciousness, a comprehensive overview of psychedelic studies, which is the 50 interviews that I just mentioned. We've transcribed them into a large two-volume set that I'm either going to publish myself or have published here very soon. And then I'm also working on this Secret History of Magic Mushrooms project that we talked about today. And I encourage people to please donate to the Gnostic Media podcast, and especially to the book and DVD project on the Secret History of the Magic Mushrooms, because we need funding. We're independent media, and we can't do it without direct public support. And so all of the information I'm trying to get out about Gordon Wasson's actions with the CIA in funding magic mushrooms and all of this stuff. If we don't have public support, we won't be able to get it out there. So everyone's support is really appreciated on that.
My friend, not just coming from me, but coming from the entire listenership of Occult Science Radio, we want to extend a wholehearted thanks to you, my friend, for taking time out of your busy schedule to be here with us this evening. Everybody, please visit TriviumEducation.com. You know,
and GnosticMedia.com.
GnosticMedia.com. Let me tell you something, friends. On both of those websites, you are going to come across some information that is totally going to change your mind. I mean, you know, Jan even has on the TriviumEducation.com also has a section in there on teaching Trivium to your children. Okay, and, you know, I wish I had come across this information like 20 years ago. My oldest son is 21 now and in college, and my youngest son is just turned 15 and he's a sophomore in high school. You know, had I come across this information 20 years ago, you know, I probably would not have sent, you know, my children into what I've heard called the killing fields, you know, more commonly known as the public school system.
Absolutely.
But hey, you know, for those of us who have already been, you know, suffered the damage of the killing fields or have children that are currently in the killing fields, TriviumEducation.com and GnosticMedia.com. And I can assure you, with that information, you can undo the damage that, you know, the public education system is doing to our children and has even done to us. Brother Jan, it was a pleasure. Be well, my friend. I'll be in touch. You're going to be back real soon.
All right. Thank you, sir. Have a good one, Curtis.
Thank you. Be well, my friend. Peace. Thank you so much. And we also want to thank you as well, family, for being here with us this evening on Occult Science Radio. As I always said, you could have been anywhere else, you know, but you chose to be here with us, especially with the NBA playoffs being in full effect and the baseball season just starting. But you chose to be here with us on Occult Science Radio, and we love and we are thankful to you for that. You know, let us know that we're doing something special here and you keep us inspired. Tune in tomorrow evening at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time when we will have with us Sister Ty Phoenix, who you will see in her most recent work, and I have to say work of art, you know, directed by Sister Stacy Muhammad. The name of the documentary is For Colored Boys. You know, she is also what I would say an enlightened recording artist. That is going to be a very powerful interview as well. We've got a great lineup this week. You know, we've also got Sandra Sabatini coming up from the Pythagoras Conference. We've got Mark Passio coming up. You know, and we also have coming back another giant, Santos Bonacci. So we've got some great shows coming up, as well as Sister Nia Yah, Priestess Mukajara, coming up on Wednesday. So stay tuned to Occult Science Radio with this week and next week. We've got some powerful guests on tap. And with that, beloved family, as I always say, peace, love, and power. And please, please walk with strength. Peace.
Yeah. Everybody says it's real. Today I take a step into a time and space
of peace
and possibility. And here I'm gonna stay until I find my place, my true divinity. I'm getting